From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Sometimes a film score tells the story all by itself. That's the theme for Darth Vader from Star Wars. We'll talk about a new orchestra that wants to be the sound of the movies. First, though, all this week we've gotten responses to the rallies in Charlottesville and the attack that left one woman dead over the weekend.
While the tragedy that happened in Charlottesville was terrible, it was not unpredictable.
That's journalist Jared Yates Sexton. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Brandon. I am from Atlanta, but I currently live in Americus, Georgia. This is a part of our history. The way people who are talking about it right now is as this is as if this is not like a thing that has happened before in the recent past with Bill and Ruth, who was also a self-avowed white supremacist. My grandparents grew up in Jim Crow. My mom she went to a segregation school, so. And she is in her mid-50s.
Hector Fernandez writes to us, "It's so sad that over 400,000 U.S. service members died in World War II fighting a state that espoused such intolerant views, and we now have a head of state who promotes and supports these very views for his political benefit." We would love to get your thoughts. Call and give us your opinion at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The white supremacists in Charlottesville last weekend were not all part of one group, but a conglomeration of several: the KKK, alt-righters, white nationalists, and swastika-waving neo-Nazis. Reporter A.C. Thompson of ProPublica was there covering the chaos, and he's been tracking hate groups for ProPublica's Documenting Hate project. And A.C. joins me from California by Skype. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
And also with us is University of Maryland psychology professor Ariai Kruglansky. He studies the psychological processes behind radicalization, de-radicalization, and terrorism. Hi there, Ariai.
Good morning, Celeste.
Just a warning for listeners, some of the things we're about to discuss might not be suitable for children. Let's go to you, A.C. Thompson, especially in light of the president's press conference in which he was talking about possibly some good people that were among the neo-Nazi white supremacist group. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, well, from having been on the ground there, I'll tell you that overwhelmingly, the people who were involved in the Unite the Right protest were white supremacists of one variety or another: neo-fascists, neo-Confederates, white nationalists, et cetera. I saw and met nobody who wasn't a part of some sort of white supremacist movement while I was interviewing people there. And I interviewed a lot of people there. I didn't see or meet any sort of average mainstream Republicans or conservatives who just said, we really love this monument. We don't want it to go. I think the president is mistaken if he thinks that there were groups other than white supremacists that played any significant role in participating in the protest.
So, Ariai, we in the past year since 9/11, we've talked a lot about how young Muslims especially become radicalized. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about how white men become radicalized. And it appears from the statistics that that's actually the group that's the largest danger to Americans. Why is this not a point of discussion?
I think it's because the Muslim threat has been amplified by the media. It's been all over the news, and it's the media that have really not paid enough attention to this growing threat. Not only in this country, but also in Europe, the proportion of attacks by white supremacists, neo-Nazis, fascists, and so forth exceeds by far that by Muslims. So it's a hidden danger, as great a danger as that of Islamic extremism that has been under the radar for a long while.
So I want to play you, AC, this comment from Robert Ray. He is actually a contributor to the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking to Vice News in this comment, talking about how the internet has actually made it easier for him and his organization.
For instance, last night at the Torch Walk, there were hundreds and hundreds of us. People realize they're not atomized individuals. They're part of a larger whole because we have been spreading our memes. We have been organizing on the internet. And so now they're coming out. And now, as you can see today, we greatly outnumbered the anti-white, anti-American filth.
How would you say the internet has contributed to organization of protests and also of these hate groups?
You know, I think his point is absolutely important to note. The internet is really the propulsive mechanism behind the new white supremacist movement. Absolutely. These folks are meeting each other on the internet, like the Daily Stormer, for example, had a forum, they called it their book club, where you could network with other local neo-Nazis and meet up in real life and go shoot guns. People posted pictures of themselves doing that or do whatever. And so a lot of people that ended up in Charlottesville organized on this forum and then grouped up to come together to the event. The internet is a place where neo-Nazi groups, white supremacist groups have leveraged social media and have used social media in incredibly effective ways to make new recruits, to make new converts, and to network.
So this is really very similar to the way that ISIS supporters have been mobilized. And I think that from a psychological perspective, it's a very important point because due to the fact that violence is generally shunned in civilized society, you need a support group that legitimizes it. And the internet provides that, the network that the internet creates provides validation and vindication of violence as a means of attaining political religious goals. And this also relates to the great weight that is given to the president's seeming approval, seeming support for these activities that surfaced in the last 2 days. That, again, you know, a major figure, the president of the United States, is condoning in some sense, these behaviors, that is a tremendous sense of validation of behaviors that the general society, the mainstream, shuns and condemns.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Arie Kuglansky, whose voice you just heard, University of Maryland psychology professor and ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, who specializes in reporting on extremist groups. I want to play for you both two comments from Christopher Cantwell. He is with the Unite the Right movement, and he spoke with Vice News over the weekend in Charlottesville. And again, a warning for our listeners, this is upsetting. These are upsetting comments. Take a listen.
When the Trayvon Martin case happened, you know, Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and all these different things happened, every single case, it's some little black behaving like a savage, and he gets himself in trouble, shockingly enough. Whatever problems I might have with my fellow white people, they generally are not inclined to such behavior.
And here's the second one where he says, in fact, although he supports Donald Trump, he is not the ideal.
I'm here to spread ideas, talk, in the hopes that somebody more capable will come along and do that. Somebody like Donald Trump who does not give his daughter to a Jew.
So Donald Trump, but, like, more racist.
Yeah, a lot more racist than Donald Trump.
AC, there has been a number of, again, I want to go back to the president's comments just because they're echoed now among many conservatives, what we're talking about, especially with somebody like Cantwell, is a tiny, tiny minority, and that for the most part, they're talking about the problem for many of these groups is that they feel they have been left behind or that they have legitimate complaints. How do you view those claims?
Meaning that the president's saying there was a tiny minority of white supremacist groups at the rally?
No, these extremists, like the comments that we just heard, are the exception.
You know, I mean, here's the thing. The thing is that the Trump era, the Trump message, has helped to galvanize and catalyze an entire new generation of white supremacists. And he is, in many ways, a key component to this combustible mixture that we have now. And what I would say is, yes, many of these people, like Chris Cantwell, who advocates throwing people out of helicopters, have moved beyond Trump. And when you interview people on the ground in Charlottesville and at other white supremacist rallies, they'll say, Trump, yeah, he's not our perfect guy, but he opened the door to this new racial consciousness. And he was the first white politician in decades to speak openly about race. And they take great solace in his messaging. They know that his refusal to immediately disavow them, that was a signal to them. That was a signal saying, hey, you know, basically I'm on your side. This is the wink. And they are looking for the subtle signals. They know eventually he has to disavow David Duke or the white supremacist movement or whatever. But they follow his Twitter intently. They follow his messaging intently. And they feel like they are constantly getting signs of support, subtle signs of support. And the truth is, they are right about that.
Well, REI, let me ask you, because we got responses that the young man who has been is now accused of committing murder with his car. And also there is another family that came out and absolutely disavowed their son who marched with the white supremacists. Those families expressed surprise. They said, I don't know where he got learned those views. I don't know. This is a shock to us. How does a family know? How does this begin?
Again, you know, it's very similar and echoes the process that happens with Muslim extremists. The families very often are surprised because it's surreptitious. It's carried out with chat rooms and the social media without the knowledge of the family. If the young person knows that the family is against it, he's going to conceal it. But I wanted to also add another dimension, and that is that however important Trump's endorsement of this movement is, he is not the sole source of the problem. The problem has been global. In this country and around the world, there has been a rise in extremism, in fascism, in neo-Nazism. That has been the case in Europe. And it has received legitimation from political parties to the right. So there is a kind of continuity, and the same thing has been happening in this country before Trump. So there are general global reasons, such as the uncertainty, the economic uncertainty, the turmoil produced by waves of immigration, by refugees, the sense of some people, some young people, that their sense of future, their prospect, their sense of respect and significance are endangered. And that opens the psychological space for extremist ideologies of the kind that these movements are endorsing.
That is REI Kuglansky. He's a University of Maryland professor. We also have ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson with us. Just ahead, we continue this conversation. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about the new generation of white supremacists who surfaced at this weekend's rally in Charlottesville. My guests are ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, who joins us by Skype, and also on the line is University of Maryland psychology professor REI Kuglansky. And again, a note, some of the things we are discussing may be unsuitable for children. Let me play you another comment here, and this is actually Licia Brooks. She's the outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she's talking to NPR about the fact that people of color often have conversations with children about what it means to be a person of color in America, and those conversations don't happen with white kids. So take a listen.
white families need to have conversations with their children, with their grandchildren, with their nieces and their nephews about what it means to be white in America. These young white men are vulnerable to the messages from white supremacy who would tell them that multiculturalism or an emphasis on diversity and inclusion means that they're going to be excluded.
So, AC, we've talked a little bit about once they get to some of these websites and things, how they then become swayed by these arguments. But what leads them to those websites? How do they even begin?
You know, I think Professor Kuglansky's points earlier were worth noting. You know, I think there is a general unease about terrorism, and that is blamed in this country largely on folks from outside the country or towards immigrants and people of color, people of religious minorities. So that's one sort of factor that is radicalizing people. There is the truth that demographics are changing in America. And I think there's a sense from a lot of young white men that they will be a minority, and they have seen how other minorities are treated in this country, and they don't like that prospect. I think a third thing that was brought up is economics. And I think there's a unease about where the economy is going and where the future lies for working people in this country. And instead of sort of thinking about what is a way to create a better, more equitable, more just economy, the notion is, hey, there's people to blame for our economic problems. Let's get them out of the country. And I think there's real factors like that. I'll also say, you know, the online video gaming culture in this country is really rife with racism. And so there are millions of people playing online video games every day, every night, and they're communicating with each other through various messaging.
And sexism and misogyny, I should say.
Yeah, and sexism and misogyny. Thank you. Through various messaging systems. And there is all kinds of crazy discourse going on in the on those platforms that is racist, homophobic, sexist, xenophobic. And I think that's another gateway.
So, Professor Kuglansky, maybe play you this comment from former FBI agent Michael German. He's speaking with NPR here about the fact that many white supremacists are not actually violent.
There are millions of racists in the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are with organized white supremacist groups. Very few actually commit acts of violence. There are also people who are not part of the white supremacist movement or any ideological movement who commit mass atrocities. So we have to understand that the ideology, it's neither necessary or sufficient to the violence that we're trying to control.
So, REI, it sounds like he's saying that just because you're a white supremacist doesn't mean you're a danger. Is there something of concern just in being a white supremacist?
Yes, definitely. I think there is a continuity between political views and the use of extreme means such as violence to advance those views. There is a continuity between the political right that is legitimized around the world in various parties that try to govern those states, and the kind of less legal means of advancing similar ideas through violence and through mayhem. So it is true that rather few those who participate in right-wing extremist movement actually commit violence, but many of them endorse violence committed by others. Now, from the psychological perspective, to actually engage in acts of violence requires a degree of commitment that very few would have. Because this degree of commitment means foregoing all else, endangering one's life, one's career, one's future for the cause. And very few people are willing to do that. So they may endorse the views, endorse the activities of others, while themselves going pretty much about their business. But there are moments in time where the emotions prevail, for example, when symbolic issues such as statues of historical significance or music or a kind of circumstance where people are drunk and emotionally aroused, that they can commit to violence. So I think, you know, the fact that the ideology endorses violence and allows it can slide into violence under specific circumstances, where people are willing to commit all for the cause.
All right. So, AC, this is your area. Extremism is your area of expertise. That's what you report on. It means you're going into danger, frankly, in over the course of your job. I want to play you this comment again from Lecia Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And she's talking about the fact that this whole issue is something the U.S. is just not grappling with.
It's important for people to speak out and recognize things for what they are. Recognize that there's a tremendous rise in white supremacy, in violent domestic terrorism. We are on the brink of violence in this country due to the rise in extremism from the far right.
Is there a way, and I'm going to ask you as well, Professor, but AC, do you think there is a way at this point that we can prevent this, as a nation, that we can prevent this?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I think a key thing is going to be leadership from the top, and we're not seeing that. And so in the absence of that, I think what we're going to see, and what may be hopeful and may be something of a remedy, is action from the bottom, is people in the streets, people in the communities, people at the local level saying, this is not what we're about. This is not what America is about to us. And
I want to echo that very strongly, because the United States is among the few nations that are not doing anything about it. There is a very strong tradition of counter-violent extremist program in European nations that has gathered a lot of experience of how to do it. Germany has a 10-year CVE program, very well developed, and there is a lot of experience there. Denmark has the Aarhus model that is very promising. The UK has the PREVENT program. And as AC pointed out, it has to happen on the local level, from the ground up. It cannot be imposed by the government. There is an organization of strong cities. I just recently participated in their meeting in Denmark. Some American cities are members of that network. And these cities organize the societal institutions, the social services, the educational institutions, the religious institutions, in order to combat and prevent extremism. Yeah. This is the address that families whose children are showing signs of extremism can turn to. Police is involved.
Yeah.
So it is a whole community effort to counter this dangerous, pernicious wave. And we do not see hardly any of that in our country, and that needs to happen.
That is University of Maryland Professor Ariai Kuglansky and also ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shadow of the Lions is the debut novel from Atlanta author Chris Swan. It's a thriller about a man whose best friend disappeared during their senior year of high school, and then he eventually returns to the school to teach English and is immersed in a mystery that is much bigger than just his friend's disappearance. Chris Swan is the author and English professor at Holy Innocence Episcopal School in Atlanta. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Celeste.
I have to say, since you wrote this murder mystery based at a boarding school and you work at a private school like this, I mean, you must get questions from the students and the faculty about how much is based on your own school.
Yeah.
But there haven't been any murders at Holy Innocence.
No, there have not been. And it's a disappearance rather than a murder. We don't really know what happened at the school in the book. But yeah, I went to boarding school in Virginia.
Yeah.
And
I was just trying to think if anybody died.
Well, yes, there
yeah,
are.
Yeah, there's death.
There is. But just trying to, the main thing I wanted to try to do was have the best friend lose his friend and not know what happened to him. If it was clear that he had died, then there's sort of an ending there. There's a closing, not knowing what happened to his friend. His friend runs off into the woods and vanishes, and he feels guilty about it. The protagonist does, because he got in an argument with his friend.
Not just him, but just right. Because of that absence, it affects,
yeah.
The ripple effect is huge. It changes people's lives, the not knowing.
Exactly. What that kind of shadow does that cast on the main character's life from then on?
What is it about a thriller that you like?
I've always liked stories, intelligently written thrillers, that involve pretty powerful characters. You get an author, somebody like Martin Cruz Smith, who wrote Gorky Park and this series of novels. New York Times said he's one of our best thriller writers, but also one of our best writers, period. And I like stories that straddle those lines. You get interested in the characters, and the story is what hooks you in. Most stories are a mystery of some sort. You want to know what happens next. Are these two going to end up together? You know, I teach high school. Is Hamlet going to end up finally getting off his duff and avenging his father's death?
Right. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. What's going to happen next? And so I think people like thrillers because they like the excitement. They like the mystery. They like the anticipation of what's going to happen next. The trick as a writer is to keep that anticipation going without frustrating the reader.
So what is it about a boarding school? I mean, even things like Harry Potter, there are so many books that are based at a boarding school. Why?
Well, that's a good question. And part of this book, I was resistant to write at first because I was a little intimidated, frankly, because there are so many stories written and set in boarding schools. I think for many people, boarding schools are still somewhat mysterious. That's not the way that most Americans, for instance, are educated in secondary school. And so there's this sense of what's going on there. It's a closed environment. They each have their own idiosyncrasies and rituals, basically their own community, their own society. And I think when you're a teenager, everything is pretty much ramped up. It's about you. That's who you
drama.
Are at that age. Right. Everything is dramatized. And that's who you are at the time. So an environment like a boarding school is almost like a hothouse. So when anything like this happens, even for the adults and the faculty, it's potentially compelling and explosive.
And, you know, and listeners may notice that I'm not asking a lot of questions specifically about the book, and that's because it's really difficult to ask even one without hitting a spoiler because things happen almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's continue with this line of the kids, because part of the drama of the book is about people making assumptions, and kids are so much even more prone to this than adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes part of the storytelling, is sort of the Lord of the Flies atmosphere at this school. But that must be something. How much of your own personal experience did you use at least to inform you about these stereotypes and presumptions that are made?
Right. Well, I think that both as a teacher at Holy Innocents here, going into my 22nd year, and as a graduate of a boarding school, I drew on experiences both of those places and remembering what it was like to be a teenager. And I vaguely remember being 14, 15 years old. And Lord of the Flies, I guess it works to some extent, but it's not like it's some sort of cutthroat, horrible competition. But there is this sense of, there's a heightened sense of drama when you're a teenager. There is a heightened sense of, this is about me. And it's not necessarily conscious you're trying to be selfish. It's just that's how your brain works. And at the same time, you do forge these relationships. Very powerful ones. You know, when you're a kid, when you're a teenager, these are the relationships you can often have for the rest of your life. And that's sort of what I wanted to play with, was the main character, Matthias, his best friend Fritz goes missing. And like we said earlier, what kind of a effect does that have on him?
And everybody else.
And everybody else at the school. And there are even there's times when later Matthias as an adult is talking about it, and one of his friends calls, says, this didn't just happen to you. You know, this happened to all, that we're all his friend. I like the dramatic possibilities of that.
And the one other thing that sort of comes out is that although they had these many times relationships that lasted for years and years and years, one of the things that Matthias realizes is that these people he's interacted with, he doesn't actually know them. As he interacts
right.
them with them as an adult, he starts thinking, wow, I didn't know you at all.
Well, you think you do, and then you that's one thing about making relationships early on, then when you're older as an adult going back, you make assumptions, and then you realize, okay, there's more to this person than just, for instance, you know, football player, you
right.
know, a science student, whatever label you want to put on. And people do grow and change. I mean, you know, God, I hope so. and I tried to do that with this story. But yeah, part of Matthias's problem is he has not grown and changed a whole lot from his childhood to when he's a young adult going back to teach. He thinks he has.
So in the 30 seconds that we have left, this isn't a spoiler because we don't get the answer in the novel, but does he end up writing another book?
Might have to see him in a sequel.
Dang it. That is Atlanta author Chris Swan. His new book is called Shadow of the Lions. He will be at the Atlanta History Center tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Chris, it's a great book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
Just ahead, a Georgia orchestra wants to make music for Georgia films. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk about the rise of women and people of color in films and TV. We'll talk with Atlanta producer Will Packer. He produced a lot of hit films like Girls Trip and Straight Outta Compton. But we want to include you in that conversation. So do you make choices about movies to see based on whether or not there's a diverse cast? Or do you just want a good movie and it doesn't matter who's in it? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. So look, who doesn't love a good movie soundtrack? That's the theme music from Indiana Jones. Most film music is recorded in L.A., New York, or abroad. But that could change, may change. The newly formed Peach State Orchestra wants to be the first premier film scoring orchestra in Georgia. And with me is founder and conductor Philip Allen. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So what makes a good film score? In other words, we know John Williams, obviously Star Wars, Indiana Jones, tons and tons. We know people like Hans Zimmer. We'll hear a little of his middle. What makes their stuff so good for movies?
Great, great question. Movie scores are subservient to the story and the plot. Emotionally, these composers try to underscore the vision of the director and his vision for the movie emotionally. And that could be a little ambiguous and a little bit of a challenge. But we all know these scores that, you like we just heard, instantly you're there.
Yeah, so let's play a little bit of Hans Zimmer, who's a very well-known composer. This is from the 2014 film Interstellar. So sometimes an orchestra that has to perform a movie soundtrack has to bring in some non-traditional sounds. That sounded like they had an organ, but sometimes you have to put all kinds of sound effects in there. How do you
Absolutely.
Do that?
Absolutely. Sometimes the effects are added after the fact, but you're right. The orchestra has to morph its sound and how they play, whether it's the bow of the violin or the articulation in the brass or the woodwinds or percussion. It's a huge department. They have to bring to life the special sounds. And sometimes it's difficult, but and also they're sight reading.
Right.
They're sight reading as they're recording.
Right. Sight reading, for listeners, that's when you have not seen literally on first sight. You're performing as soon as you lay eyes on the music.
Very difficult.
Okay, so then let's hear an example of some classical music that was just written to be an art piece.
Sure.
But then was used in a modern film. This is Ravel's Provence for a Dead Princess. Mm. It was used in the 2014 film Birdman. So very often they make new recordings of these pieces for films, and there's a reason for that. Is it okay to ignore what the maestro has written on the score if you're trying to play it for a specific moment in a film?
Wow, what a great, great question. You know, as a classical musician, my first training is to serve the composer. However, if you have a producer hiring you to bring to life his vision and a certain emotion to a scene, you sort of need to serve the vision of who's hired you, for lack of a better. It's a little more
so
pragmatic.
Ravel takes back seat. It's making
you
uncomfortable
to say
that.
Saying that.
You are just trying to get time. You into classical music jail.
Oh, yes, big time.
So why do we need the Peach State Orchestra? Why do we need a movie orchestra here in Georgia?
Well, that's a really, really great question. About 15 years ago, I had this vision and tried to launch an orchestra back then, but then the economy tanked.
Yes.
And so since then, all this production work that has come about, and our listeners may or may not know, the Governor Nathan Deal just recently signed into law a 30% tax incentive for post-production. That went into effect on July 1st.
Which includes, of course,
absolutely.
The score.
Post-production, people may or may not know, is sound effects, editing, looping, which is voiceovers, music, the whole assembly of the final product, which now happens in L.A. So we're hoping to capture some directors' interest and also we have some phenomenal world-class musicians here in Atlanta that I want to showcase and are ready to score movies.
Why do you have this passion for this as opposed to just playing in a traditional orchestra and playing your Mahler and your Beethoven, your Copland?
There's something about movie music. And when I was in school at Georgia State back in the late 70s, I remember going to see Star Wars for the first time when it first came out. And there might have been 15 people in the theater before the phenomena hit. And the thing, that impact of that John Williams score, which we know in that time period transformed movie scores.
Yeah, we're going to hear a clip of it.
Okay,
let's hear
again.
A little bit of it, and then we'll continue. This is from Star Wars The Force Awakens,
yes.
Of course, the great John Williams. So John Williams is often seen as just sort of the pinnacle of a movie composer. Why did Star Wars change everything for composers, at least?
Great, great question. Up until the 1977 movie release of Star Wars, it had become fashionable to get away from the big, huge symphonic orchestra sounds that were very prevalent back in the 30s and 40s. And in the 50s, it became more rock and roll, and that sort of was the genre. And then thanks to George Lucas, with the vision of wanting to hear this symphonic sound, of course, John Williams delivers in amazing ways. He's
the Mahler
it.
Of movie orchestras.
Absolutely.
He likes lots of people in the recording studio.
And you hear that theme, and you're instantly back at the movie. Your mind is there. So I have a passion for movie music,
which is always been interesting to me, because John Williams and some of the really great music composers are melodists.
That's correct.
Whereas when we think of writing for movies, we think of atmospheric music, which doesn't have a melody to distract from the action. How do you balance those two things?
That is a really great question. I've heard several interviews with John Williams, and Star Wars is what he would term way over the top. The music becomes another character versus some of the mood pieces that you hear. They have melodies, but they're not so intrusive into your psyche. They support the emotion of the moment, depending what the scene is portraying. But I hate to keep harping on John Williams, but there's, like you said, Hans Zimmer. There's some phenomenal composers out there that.
And we have some who weird it up, like Danny Elfman.
I love Danny Elfman. Absolutely.
All right, so let's hear a little bit of a lighter music.
Sure.
This is from the French film Amélie. So again, we're dealing with a score that if you were to play it, you need to find an accordionist.
That's correct. That's correct. You're very good there, Seth.
How many musicians do you end up either as your core and then rotating?
Well, a lot of it depends on budget. We have the Peach State Orchestra is an 80-member symphony orchestra, full symphony orchestra.
That's a full size, yeah.
It's a traditional orchestra in that we don't have ukuleles or bagpipes or accordions.
Banjos.
However, there are all those players here in Atlanta that if the score calls for that, we could invite them to come in.
That scene is already here.
Absolutely. And a lot of really phenomenal players. Here.
So make your pitch for me. If I'm a filmmaker, and I am not, but if I am, and I need to get my score recorded, why do it with the Peach State Orchestra?
Well, Celeste, come make your movie in Georgia, film it, produce it, and let us help you bring your vision to the screen, packaged right here in Georgia from start to finish. And using world-class musicians here, taking advantage of those tax breaks, and let's make a movie.
And certainly the conductor is going to be passionate about it. Let's hear one more clip. This is a sort of a darker sound. This is from the film Requiem for a Dream. Now, I have a friend of mine who plays in a movie orchestra, and he says the percussionist is often the most important part.
I would agree.
Right. Okay. So explain why that is and why those drum beats end up have to be so perfectly synced with the action.
Percussion is such a broad field. Having minored in percussion, there's so many instruments at your disposal, both for the composer, the orchestrator, but percussion is sort of the icing on the cake and punctuates. You know, woodwinds and strings are very legato, and brass can be legato or brass can be punchy.
Legato is smooth.
That's right. And that's wonderful, and you need all those textures. But something about percussion that brings to life the energy, like you're saying, especially if it's a pacing on the screen or some kind of heartbeat rhythm in the background. A lot of times it's subliminal, what percussionists are doing. Of course, then you've got the chimes and the timpani and all the standard mallet things, too. But
yeah. It's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good word.
Conductor Philip Allen created the Peach State Orchestra. It's set to become the premier orchestra for recording film scores right here in Georgia. Their first concert is next Friday, August 25th, 7:30 p.m. at the Innovation Amphitheater. Philip, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Today is the anniversary of John Pemberton's death. Pemberton is Coca-Cola's inventor and founder. It's been more than 130 years since he walked into Jacobs Pharmacy in Atlanta to introduce the world to Coca-Cola. The beverage giant has called the city home ever since. We took a trip to the Coca-Cola Freestyle Innovation Lab to learn the story behind the drink's first pour.
When you hear the carbonated water go into the glass today, it's exactly what it would have sounded like in 1886 when they did it at Jacobs Pharmacy.
Yes, for a bright taste and a bracing sparkle, for perfect refreshment every time, there's nothing like ice-cold Coca-Cola.
My name is Ted Ryan, and I'm the historian for the Coca-Cola Company. 130 years ago, when Pemberton took the syrup up there, he would have 1 ounce of syrup in the glass and then 5 ounces of carbonated water, a quick stir, and hand it to the customer to enjoy their ice-cold Coca-Cola.
Yes, and Coca-Cola is so delicious, so refreshing, so tempting to any guest when you bring out those familiar bottles with tiny beads of moisture running down their frosty sides, assuring you that the Coke inside is really ice-cold.
And they would have added a number of different flavors. In Jacob's Pharmacy that first day when Coca-Cola was served, there were over 30 flavors on tap. There were lemons, limes, cordials, chocolate, claret, sarsaparilla, root beer. So what set Coca-Cola apart was its unique flavor. Nothing else tasted like a Coca-Cola. What we have in front of us is a syrup urn from 1896. It looks like a Greek urn that you would see at Acropolis or something like that. It would hold up to a gallon of syrup, and Asa Candler distributed these for free to any soda fountain that bought 50 gallons of syrup. And so when you walked in the soda fountain, the first thing you're going to see is an urn that has Coca-Cola and written in its beautiful script in the color red, and it would dispense 1 ounce of syrup into a glass at the base of the urn. I've just put the glass on the base of the syrup urn, and now I'm dispensing 1 ounce of the syrup. You remove the glass, add the carbonated water. Give it a quick stir, hand it to the customer, and they have a vintage 1896 Coca-Cola. People think that since it's 130 years old, there have to have been changes. You don't have to change it. It's good.
Because even after your first long drink, there's still lots more than you think. Coca-Cola gives you that refreshing new feeling. Get the king-size Coke.
What goes inside a Coke hasn't changed, but the technological evolution has occurred around how you consume a Coke or how you get a Coke. So up until 1932, everything is syrup and then carbonated water stirred and handed to you. After 32, it becomes automated. And then again in 1939, the company hired this famous industrial designer named Raymond Loewy. And Loewy designed what we call the motorboat dispenser. It's this beautiful, retro-looking, curved, and it looked beautiful. And it was so pretty that actually customers of ours, soda fountains across America, were asking to update their equipment to this new designed soda fountain equipment. And then when you move up into today, this your Coke is delivered to you in a fascinating new piece of equipment called Freestyle.
That's obviously the ice coming out. My name is Chris Hellman, and I'm the Global Vice President of the Freestyle Division. Freestyle is our latest innovation in dispensing technology, and I guess the simplest way to put it is that in about the same footprint as a fountain dispenser that you see in most places, we can dispense up to 150 different variations of drinks. I think we've retained very much of our heritage. We've really tried to stay consistent, not just with the formula, which we have, and to carry that through for 130 years, but we've tried to maintain this connection with our consumers that's special and fun.
Things go better with Coke. Life is much more fun when you're refreshed.
Sound from our visit to Coca-Cola's Freestyle Innovation Lab in Atlanta. And that's our show for today, but as always, we would love to hear your thoughts. We talked this hour about the radicalization of young white men. What do you think we can do to prevent more young men from becoming extremists? Give us your thoughts at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Ryan McFadden, and Trevor Young. Our senior producer is Emily Curtin. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. Our theme music is by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.